Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio. I'm your host, Dave Custy. Today, my guest is Kevin J. Cullen, M.D. Kevin J. Cullen, M.D. has been the director of the University of Maryland Marlene and Stuart Greenebaum Cancer Society and professor of medicine at the University of Maryland School of Medicine since January of 2004. Dr. Cullen is a head and neck cancer specialist. Under his leadership, the Cancer Center has significantly expanded its clinical and research programs and was named a National Cancer Institute Designated Cancer Center in 2008. Before coming to the University of Maryland, Dr. Cullen was affiliated with the Lombardi Cancer Center at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. for 15 years and served as interim director for 2 years. He was a professor of medicine, oncology, and otolaryngology at the Georgetown University School of Medicine. Dr. Cullen serves on the National Board of the American Cancer Society and on the external advisory boards of several NCI-designated cancer centers. He was selected by President Barack Obama to serve on the National Cancer Advisory Board and advisory committee to the NCI. He is the author of numerous journal publications and has served on review panels for the NCI, the Veterans Administration Research Program, and other organizations. He has received the NCI Special Achievement Award, the American Cancer Society South Atlantic Division Service Award, and the Ullman Cancer Fund for Young Adults Hope Award. He has been named a top doctor by Baltimore and Washingtonian magazines. A graduate of Dartmouth College and Harvard Medical School, Dr. Cullen completed his internship and residency at Beth Israel Hospital in Boston and received additional training at the NCI. Welcome to Baltimore Internet Radio, Dr. Cullen.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Might you give me a short bio in your own words?
Well, you know, I think anybody who works in the cancer field can point to some event or events that push them in that direction. And for me, it was, the experience that I had as a kid growing up. You mentioned, and we'll talk about, I'm sure, later on, the 50th anniversary of the Surgeon General's report on tobacco. I grew up in a household where both of my parents smoked, and my mother especially was a heavy smoker. When I was in high school, my mother developed lung cancer, and she died just after I graduated from high school. My father developed leukemia later on when I was in medical school, but it really was both of those experiences that pushed me in the direction that I've followed since then. It was the early experience that caused me to decide to pursue a career in medicine, and more specifically in cancer medicine.
How did you get interested in head and neck cancer?
I did my specialty training in oncology, medical oncology, at the National Cancer Institute in Bethesda, and I was recruited as I was finishing my fellowship to move with my mentor at the time to Georgetown University, to the Lombardi Cancer Center. And I was working primarily in breast cancer at the time. I was working in a breast cancer laboratory at the National Cancer Institute, and I set up my own breast cancer laboratory at Georgetown, and was being quite successful, reasonably successful there. And then the director at the time said, you know, we've just recruited a spectacular head and neck surgeon, specialist in head and neck cancer from Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York, a guy named Roy Sessions, and we'd like you to work with him because we don't have another medical oncologist who's available who could work with him. And I said, gee, I haven't really done anything in that area. And I remember my first meeting with Roy Sessions, who is a wonderful physician, just a lovely gentleman and a spectacular surgeon. And I had a meeting set up shortly after he arrived at Georgetown, and he said, so you're the medical oncologist that I'm going to be working with? And I said, yes, it's nice to meet you. And he said, so have you done a lot of work in head and neck cancer? And I said, well, actually, no, I haven't done any. We didn't do head and neck cancer at all in the National Neck Cancer Institute. And that kind of stopped the conversation for a couple of minutes. And he looked at me and says, well, do you know how to give chemotherapy? And I said, oh, yes, I can do that. I'm quite well trained to do that. So he was flabbergasted. What did he get himself into? Here he was being partnered with a doctor who knew nothing about head and neck cancer and had not had any experience in that area at all. But that relationship came about at a time when the medical management of head and neck cancer was changing very, very rapidly. He was a superb physician and started to attract patients from all over the area. And I learned a lot from him, and I got into that by chance at a time when the field was changing very rapidly. And really, in the last 20 years, the management of head and neck cancer has changed dramatically. And some of the work that he and I began and that I've continued with others has helped contribute to that.
be a little bit more specific on what do you mean by head and neck cancer specialist?
Head and neck cancer is a group of cancers that arise in the mouth and the throat, and that can be in the oral cavity around the lips, the tongue, the tonsils, the base of the tongue, the voice box. And so these cancers have traditionally been associated with people who have a significant tobacco history, and commonly tobacco in combination with alcohol. But one of the interesting things, one of the things that I've been very much focused on recently, it's become apparent in the last 10 years or so, that we're seeing an epidemic of head and neck cancer that has nothing to do with tobacco or alcohol, but has to do with the human papillomavirus, which is was originally described as a virus that causes cervical cancer. And now we know that in addition to causing cervical cancer, papillomavirus causes a significant proportion of head and neck cancers, primarily in men, and that that particular problem is increasing rapidly, and it's a public health issue that we're dealing with now.
Where does that virus come from?
Well, the virus is ubiquitous. It's been around for millennia, and really in the 70s and 80s, it became apparent that that virus was the cause of virtually 100% of cervical cancer, and that work has now been very, very well recognized. More recently, researchers at Johns Hopkins and elsewhere showed that in addition to cervical cancer, human papillomavirus causes a number of other cancers, including a significant proportion of head and neck cancers, but it also causes cancers of the genital tract, penis, vulva, anal cancers as well, and that this has been very much underappreciated, and it's important because with vaccines, these cancers are all entirely preventable.
Is there a research facility especially for this virus?
Well, there are a number of facilities that focus on it. There are two vaccines now in use, and that's come about from research in this area. One group was led by Doug Lowy at the National Cancer Institute. He's done some superb work, and the most commonly used vaccine in the United States was developed from research that took place in Bethesda at the National Cancer Institute and Doug Lowy's group. The other vaccine was also developed locally at Georgetown by a group led by Dick Schlegel, who is the chairman of pathology and is another superb papillomavirus researcher. Our group has looked at what are trends in the prevalence of papillomavirus, what does it imply in terms of the prognosis and treatment, and what are strategies that we can use to do a very detailed molecular analysis of a patient's tumor at the time they're diagnosed to determine more accurately what their prognosis is, but also what their treatment should be and how we should tailor their treatment based on the molecular profile of their tumor.
Is there a lot of early diagnosis with this? Do they have this virus?
It's an excellent question, and the answer in the head and neck is no. There's not, and there needs to be. In cervical cancer, our screening, and this is also work that the American Cancer Society has supported for many, many, many years, the screening tool that was developed more than half a century ago, the Pap smear, is still widely used, but now people have brought into use our knowledge of papillomavirus so that any woman who has even a vague suspicion of abnormal cells in her cervix is tested for papillomavirus, and if it's present, then we know that that woman's at significant risk for developing cancer, and she's followed and or treated much more aggressively. Unfortunately, there is no Pap smear equivalent in head and neck cancer, which a number of labs are trying to develop that. And part of the problem is that these infections, these HPV infections, especially in the oral cavity, are common. People get them, almost everyone is exposed to the virus at some point during their high school and college years and beyond, and people frequently will get an infection, will clear it, will get another infection, and so right now there's not the equivalent of a Pap smear that can be done to detect someone who's at high risk for developing oral cancers.
Generally, in your last 20 years, let's say, head and neck cancers, how have they progressed in terms of diagnosis, in terms of treatment?
Well, the type of patient that we see is now very, very different. When I started seeing these patients at Georgetown 20, 25 years ago, almost invariably they were older patients, predominantly men, in their 60s and 70s, who had a long history of tobacco and alcohol use. Then sort of in the last 10 years or so, we've appreciated that, gosh, you know, mixed in with those patients who we were so used to seeing, we started to see young professional men in their late 40s and early 50s who were non-smokers, and now they account for a very large proportion of the patients that we see altogether. Mm. So really the type of patient and the profile of the patient has changed drastically. The other thing that we've appreciated, while paradoxically we're seeing an explosion of head and neck cancer in men due to papillomavirus, those people do very well, and they respond very, very well to treatment, and their cure rate is extraordinarily high, approaching 100%. So that's the good news. The bad news is to get that cure rate, the treatment is very, very tough. If I see someone who's a 50-year-old lawyer from the area who's a non-smoker and he's developed a head and neck cancer due to papillomavirus, I can say to him, look, the good news is we have an extraordinarily high chance of curing you. The bad news is what we have to put you through to achieve that is very unpleasant, and you'll have some lasting side effects in terms of dry mouth and changes in speech and swallowing and things like that, which are a very high price to pay, especially now because we know that the disease is entirely preventable with vaccines, and we need to be focusing a lot of effort, more than we have, on preventing adolescents and teenagers from developing this disease when they're adults.
I guess the big difference in terms of smoking for an extended period of time is that you've been kind of destroying your insides and not giving yourself enough chance to recover from things. You mentioned about your dad as a heavy smoker. So was my dad. When he retired, he got colon cancer, lung cancer, and throat cancer.
Sure.
And he survived them all. And he was recovering from throat cancer surgery when my mother stroked. She was a smoker, too. She had congestive heart failure and was being treated for it. He stroked a week later and never woke up. But every doctor that I talked to there said it was attributed to smoking, even though he had quit smoking about 10 years earlier.
Well, it's a very good point. Smoking, everybody associates smoking with cancer, but smoking causes a huge burden of death and disease due to other causes like cardiovascular disease, heart attack, stroke, things like that. So it's not just cancer. You know, my mother had quit smoking 7 or 8 years before she was diagnosed with lung cancer. And, the point is it's always to your benefit if you are a smoker to quit. And your risk goes down. But for somebody who smoked for 20 or 30 or 40 years, a significant amount, their risk never quite gets to zero. And even though it's very, very good to stop smoking, we encourage people to do it. It diminishes their risk, but it doesn't completely remove it and guarantee that they won't have a problem with cardiovascular disease or cancer.
If you've been a smoker for 20, 30 years, and even though if you stop for 10 years, and let's say you're up in age to mid-50s or 60 or something like that, what can you do from getting these virulent cancers? I mean, is it 6 months checkups or year checkups? Or, I mean, what, I know it's impossible to say, really, but there's got to be some preventative type of stuff, I think.
There are things that are important to remember. One is if you are a smoker or have been a past smoker, it's important to keep up with all of your recommended cancer screening. And the common ones that are really important are to have a colonoscopy every 10 years or a very advanced test to look for blood in the stool once a year. That's a little less invasive and a little less costly, but you have to do it every year.
In addition to the colonoscopy?
No, there's more and more data that's emerging. It's not part of the official Preventive Services Task Force recommendations, but there's a lot of data emerging now that if you do the modern, not the old tests that we used to do when I was a resident, for blood in the stool were pretty nonspecific. And even if you had a rare hamburger the night before, that you might get a false positive test. The tests that are available now are very specific for human blood. And if you do those every year and they're all negative, then you're okay. If you do them and one of them turns up positive, then you have to have a colonoscopy just to see what's mm-hmm. going on. The standard recommendation is still to have a colonoscopy every 10 years. Some people are resistant to that because colonoscopies are not a lot of fun, obviously.
I tell you what, I like them. I've had two of them. I'm 57 years old, and I had one in my 40s because of my father, mm-hmm. and I had one over here. And I had been living in Europe for the last 10 years, and I had one in Northern Ireland about 2 years ago, even though it's the national health is great, but in preventative medicine, it took me almost 4 years to get it. So, and I was clean, and the thing about it, it was much easier this time around, because the first time around was about 10 years ago, and you had to swallow all this barium and everything like that.
Right.
But this time around, it wasn't that bad, and I guess, I think we feel better from it. And I have a couple friends of mine who have had colonoscopies, too, and we're thinking about starting a colonoscopy club.
Well, it's really, you're quite right. It's not terribly unpleasant. The prep can be a little,
yeah, it's a little off-putting.
It can be a little off-putting, but it's not unpleasant. It's safe, and it really, the benefits are tremendous. As far as the other issue, though, that you raised, what should somebody who's been a smoker do? A very interesting study came out last year, which showed that for people who had a significant smoking history, that means what we call a 30-pack year history. That means if you smoked one pack a day for 30 years, or if you smoked two packs a day for 15 years, mm-hmm. you get a 30-pack year smoking history. For somebody with more than a 30-pack year smoking history, getting a spiral CT scan, a low-dose spiral CT scan of the chest, can detect lung cancer at an early stage when it's treatable and improve survival. So that was the first lung cancer screening test that really has shown a benefit in survival. But there are a couple of things that are important to remember about that. Number one is, if you've been an occasional smoker or a light smoker, there's no benefit at all. And like any screening test, there are false positive screens, which means we put some people through lung biopsies, other procedures that for things that turn out to be benign. And those biopsies and procedures can hurt people, and they're expensive. So we really need to focus the screening on people who really need it, those people who have smoked more than 30-pack years. And the screening needs to be done in bigger centers where they have people who do this kind of stuff very, very commonly. It's generally true in medicine that if you're having a procedure, you're in better hands if you have the procedure done by somebody who does a lot of them. Mm-hmm. Same is true in this kind of screening. If your management and biopsies are being done by somebody who does a few a year, you're more likely to have a complication than if you have it done in a big center where they're doing hundreds a year.
That's a very good point. Well, let's transfer a little bit to your history there at Marlene and Stuart Greenebaum Cancer Center. Mm-hmm. It's 10 years now. Happy anniversary for you.
Thank you. It's been wonderful. I came as the director in 2000, and through a series of really fortunate but carefully planned out events, the Greenebaum Cancer Center has really become one of the nation's leading cancer centers, and we've made some very, very important contributions in the fight against cancer that I'm very proud of. The state of Maryland, around the time I came, made a very strong commitment through the Cigarette Restitution Fund program to support the cancer center, and they've invested heavily. The Greenebaum family has been superb, and they've really gotten the Baltimore business community behind us. So we've had tremendous support. The cancer center has grown tremendously. It became what was called a National Cancer Institute designated cancer center a few years ago. But most importantly, we can really point to things that we've accomplished both on the research and treatment fronts that have had a dramatic impact in cancer around Maryland and really across the world, and I'm very proud of all that.
Well, that was my next question. Give me a few of the highlights of your 10 years.
Well, one of the things that we're most proud of is the work of one of our leading researchers at Maryland, a woman named Dr. Angela Brody. Dr. Brody, several years ago, tried to develop a new drug to help treat breast cancer, and she invented at Maryland a class of drugs called aromatase inhibitors. It's really a remarkable story. This goes back a little more than 10 years when people were focusing on the use of a drug called tamoxifen in breast cancer, and that's a drug that is very important, but has a lot of nonspecific side effects and is not as clean a drug as we'd like. So she was working on a new class of drugs and thought that this would be a better way to block the stimulation that estrogen provides to breast cancer cells. And so she invented this drug. She couldn't get anybody to back her. She got no pharmaceutical companies that were interested in this because everybody was focusing on tamoxifen. And so really by force of will, she decided to set up a special laboratory within her lab, the first clinical batch of this drug. And that's unheard of. Normally, you turn to a large pharmaceutical company if you're going to manufacture a drug to give to patients. She couldn't get anybody to do that, so she made the first clinical batch of the drug herself. Then she had to shop around for a doctor and a cancer center that was willing to try this new drug in a trial. And because of the rules back a dozen years ago, she got a group in the UK, in London, to try it. And the drug was remarkably successful. And so that was the first hint that she had really come upon something very important. But what we've learned in the last few years is not only does her drug, if a woman has breast cancer, it reduces the chance of this breast cancer recurring by about 40%, all with an oral drug that's very non-toxic. More recently, it's been shown that if you're a woman at high risk for developing cancer, and you've got a strong family history and you're above 50, et cetera, et cetera, taking this pill can reduce your chance of getting breast cancer by 2/3. And then just last year, a study showed that if you are a woman who was diagnosed with breast cancer that was advanced enough that you would need a mastectomy or removal of the entire breast, that taking this drug in advance as a first step would reduce the need for a mastectomy by about 2/3. this one drug is now used worldwide by hundreds of thousands of women, and it's had a dramatic impact and saved many, many, many thousands of lives. And she's won lots of prizes and received a lot of recognition for this. But the story gets even better. You know, most people would be satisfied to say, oh, that's my crowning accomplishment. A few years ago, she said, well, I think I can do the same thing for prostate cancer. And so she used a similar strategy with Dr. Vincent Najjar, another investigator at Maryland, to come up with a new drug for prostate cancer called galetarone, and worked very well in the laboratory, worked very well in model systems. So last year, or a little over a year ago, they did the first clinical trial in men. And these were men who had advanced prostate cancer that had failed all other therapies. So these are the worst of the worst in terms of people with prostate cancer, people who are not responding to other therapies. And the drug is dramatically effective in this group of men who've really kind of exhausted most of their other options. And people were stunned in the first time this drug was ever given to people, that more than half of the people showed that they were responding to the drug. And, wow. And so the FDA has put this drug on fast-track approval status, but we're hopeful that this drug will be approved soon. And I think, you know, Dr. Brody, a few years ago, before the prostate drug came out, won what's called the Kettering Prize, which is a prize given for the person who's provided the most important new treatment for cancer in the world. So that's just short of the Nobel Prize. And now she's got this new drug for prostate cancer, which she's also invented. So we're hopeful that taken together, this will put her in the running for the Nobel Prize.
Wow.
And we're very proud of that. She's a remarkable scientist, but she's an equally delightful human being. She has, you know, she's very pleasant, has no ego, is the most collaborative and lovely mentoring person you could possibly imagine. I have enormous respect for her, and I guess that's probably the single most important achievement that the folks at our center can point to in the last few years.
Well, I'd like to get her on for a show.
She's really remarkable. She's very shy, so... It'll be a bit of a challenge get her to open up. She just doesn't like to talk about herself. There are lots of scientists who can go on for hours and hours about the work they've done, but mm-hmm. she's not one of them.
It was interesting when you were talking about the new medication for breast cancer, and I thought about all the stories you hear about... women who have a predisposition to get breast cancer, and they do preemptive double mastectomies or something,
mm-hmm.
which is, gosh, is terrible and terribly brave, too. Sounds like this medication will help alleviate that problem.
Well, it's a very good question. I think what you're talking about and what was in the press recently with Angelina Jolie and others is a mutation that was identified a number of years ago in a gene called BRCA1. BRCA1,
mm-hmm.
And women who have this gene mutation, which is passed along in families, have a very, very high incidence of developing breast and ovarian cancer. They're more likely than not to develop one or both of those diseases in their lifetime. So Angela Brody's drug has not been tested in that setting. We don't know whether this drug is strong mm-hmm. enough, given that really intense genetic predisposition. Angelina Jolie decided to have a mastectomy, and
Christina Applegate had a double.
Yeah, Christina Applegate had, and many women have both the mastectomy and they have their ovaries removed, which is a lot of, you know, a lot of very difficult surgery. It's unclear whether this drug would be strong enough to prevent that, and people have discussed prevent the need for doing that. Where it has been shown is women who have a not as compelling a family history. Most women, you know, fortunately, the BRCA gene mutation is relatively rare. It probably only accounts for less than 10% of the breast cancers that are out there. On the other hand, many women have a family history where their mother had cancer or their grandmother or a sister. They're older than 50, and we know that they're at elevated risk, but they're not at 100% risk near 100% risk the way someone like Angelina Jolie was.
Right.
So those are the women who I think it's been shown so far will benefit from Dr. Brody's drugs. It's a question for the future about people with that very difficult BRCA1 gene mutation, whether this drug will be sufficient to protect them from developing cancer.
So here's kind of a layman's question. How many different cancers do you guys research and treat over there?
It's a good question. I mean, people think of cancer as one thing. It's really a group of, really a couple of hundred diseases. We have 240 faculty researchers at the Greenbaum Cancer Center. Probably they're heavily involved in researching at least 60 diseases. But, you know, the landscape changes all the time as our tools have become more sophisticated. We identify subsets and new types of cancers within. For example, I treat head and neck cancers, as we talked about, and recently saw a young patient who had an unusual form of a head and neck cancer. And based on some work that was done up at Harvard at Dana-Farber, we identified this patient as having a very recently described rare form of head and neck cancer, the result of a very specific gene mutation. So we learn more and more about cancers on a genetic basis, on a molecular basis, and we can classify them much more accurately. In effect, that means the number of cancers is increasing because we know more specifically that not all lung cancers are the same, not all head and neck cancers are the same. And we focus on many, but certainly not all of them. You know, there are certainly are some cancer centers that have a particular interest in a particular type of cancer. Breast, head and neck cancer, GI cancer, and certainly leukemia are ones that we focus on a lot.
Do you think, just in a general scheme of cancer treatment and research, is it more two steps forward and then one step back, or one step forward and two steps back?
I think it's two steps forward and one step sideways. Globally, what I think we need to do in cancer is two things. One is we need to do a better job, and this is a major focus of the American Cancer Society, we need to do a better job of applying the things that we know. I was at a reception a while ago where I happened to be introduced to the Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, and he said to me, when he found out what I did, he said, "Will we ever have a cure for cancer?" And I said, "You know, it may seem strange, Mr. Secretary, but in a perfect world where you had complete regulation on everything to do with agriculture in the United States, in one generation you could cut cancer in the United States by two-thirds, you, the Secretary of Agriculture." And he looked at me like I was from Mars. He said, "I don't understand you." I said, "If you, as the Secretary of Agriculture said, there will never be another tobacco product sold in the United States, number one. And number two, every time you walked into McDonald's and ordered a Big Mac, the guy would say, 'Oh, can you step up on the scale, please? Oh, I'm sorry, your body mass index is too high. We're not giving you the Big Mac.'" You know, obviously, that's kind of a fanciful scenario. The Secretary of Agriculture doesn't have the power to do that, but in theory, he could. And if we did those two things, if people stopped smoking and kept their body mass index in a reasonable area, kept their weight in the normal range, we'd reduce cancer by two-thirds in the United States in 25 years. We know that head and neck cancer, cervical cancer is completely preventable, but we're doing a lousy job at vaccinating our teenagers. So we can more than cut out two-thirds of cancers by better applying the things that we know. Hepatitis virus causes a huge amount of cancer and an increasing number of cancers. So all of these things are preventable with technology and knowledge that we have today. We need to do a much better job of that. Then the next step forward need to be using our more advanced understanding of the genetics and complexities of cancer to design more tailored treatments like Angela Brody's to help prevent and cure specific cancers. Cancer won't, I don't think in my lifetime anyway, go away completely. But, you know, we've made a lot of progress so far, and if we continue to apply what we know today and use the development of new knowledge in an appropriate way, we can knock the impact of cancer down dramatically in the United States by more than two-thirds.
I would think that if you looked at when you first started out 20, 25 years ago, as you said, that you wouldn't imagine how much it would progress now.
Oh, it's absolutely right. When I was a kid, my grandmother had breast cancer when I was a little kid, and back in that day, if you got cancer in the United States, two out of three people died. When I was entering medical school, it was about 50-50. If you got cancer, you had about a 50-50 chance of being cured. And now, you know, further along in my career, if you have cancer, your chance of being cured is 2 out of 3. So we've gone from a 1 out of 3 cure rate to a 50-50 cure rate to a 2 out of 3 cure rate, all in the span of about 45 years. Have we completely eradicated cancer? No, but we've made dramatic progress, and we are making steadily more progress. The reports that the ACS issued last week showed that not only is cancer down 20% in the last 20 years, but it's continuing to decline at around 2% per year. That may not sound like but it just means that we're making great progress, and you know, the estimate is, and with the change in just the last 20 years, You know, about 1.5 million people who would have died of cancer are alive today because they either didn't get cancer or if they did, we were able to cure it.
I think people are becoming more aware of trying to take care of themselves, too. Do you feel that?
I do. I think a lot of people are making a good faith effort to take good care of themselves. But there's still, you know, we still have tens of millions of smokers in the United States.
And obesity.
And we have an epidemic of obesity, which is getting worse and contributing a lot to cancer. So I think people are certainly more cognizant of this fact, but smoking is a terrible addiction, and it's once you are a smoker, it's very difficult to break that, and I see that every day with my patients. You know, we've gotten so good in the United States at producing food compared to 50 years ago or 100 years ago that food now comparatively is very inexpensive in terms of, you know, there are obviously a lot of people who struggle in poverty, and I understand that, but by and large, the cost of putting food on the table for your family is much lower now than it was at any point in America's history. And we've produced so much food. I heard a statistic the other week. We produce more than twice as much food in terms of calories per person in the United States that they need every day. In other words, an average person in the United States should consume between 1,500 and 2,000 calories a day. We produce 4,000 calories per person per day. In the United States. So there's a huge oversupply of food, and it encourages people to overeat, and it encourages restaurants to serve huge portions, and it contributes to a lot of long-term disease issues as a result. Very, very interesting, you know, unintended consequence of what was a good faith effort to increase the availability of food and the efficiency of the agricultural sector.
So let's change gears a little bit here. January 11th was the 50th anniversary of the Surgeon General's report linking smoking to cancer. Can you address that, what's happened in the last 50 years, in a nutshell, and also your work with American Cancer Society?
Sure. As you said, the Surgeon General's report, which grew out of research that the American Cancer Society funded more than 50 years ago, really showed conclusively that tobacco use was associated with what then was a newly appreciated rising epidemic in lung cancer. Lung cancer, up until about the late 1940s and 50s, was a very uncommon disease. If you look in around 1900, the most common form of cancer in the United States was stomach cancer. Lung cancer was almost unheard of. And then as cigarettes emerged and became mass marketed in the 20s and 30s and 40s, lung cancer began to shoot up at a tremendous rate, and this was appreciated in the Surgeon General's report. And that's led to an enormous effort on multiple fronts, which has cut tobacco use by more than half in the last 50 years in the United States. So it's gone from where about 40% or more of adults in the United States smoked at the peak in the 60s, now to around, it's less than half that, about 16-18% of people in the United States, adults in the United States, smoke cigarettes. So that's a huge improvement. But still, you know, much too much. And that's resulted from a lot of things, public service campaigns. I have a friend and colleague, Joe Califano, Jr., who is a head and neck surgeon over at Johns Hopkins. And I was talking to him a while ago, and he said, I did more to treat cancer on my 10th birthday than I will ever do in my professional career. And the funny story is Joe Califano Jr.'s father was Joe Califano Sr., who was the Secretary of Health and Educational Welfare at the time under Lyndon Johnson. This was, you know,
it sounded familiar, named
a few years after the Surgeon General's report. And Joe Califano Sr. was a three-pack-a-day smoker. And for his 10th birthday, Joe Califano Sr. asked Joe Jr. what he wanted for his birthday, and Joe Jr. said, I want you to stop smoking. And his father took it to heart, and it became a crusade. And Joe Califano Sr. led a lot of the efforts in the 60s and 70s to begin to put regulation on tobacco and promote government anti-tobacco campaigns. And that was, you know, a seminal event in what has led to a dramatic decrease in smoking. And with the dramatic decrease in smoking that started in the late 60s, it took up until about 1990 when we started to see the lung cancer rates go down. And now the lung cancer rates are dropping fairly dramatically in the United States, which is great. The bad news is, while we've been successful in curtailing tobacco, we've got more to do. But in other parts of the world, in the developing world especially, tobacco rates are going up dramatically, just as they did in the United States 60, 70 years ago. So we are seeing and will see for years to come a huge burden of tobacco-related cancers in the developing world, while fortunately tobacco-related cancers in the United States are declining.
I had noticed in being in Europe in the last 10 years that they still did smoke everywhere, and there was still probably the amount of people that smoked was close to when the Surgeon General's report came out here, the 40% or so.
Oh, and some parts of Eastern Europe, the smoking rates are 65%. Mm-hmm. I was at a meeting in Moscow about a year ago, and the joke was, if you ask for a non-smoking room in a hotel, it just means nobody's smoking in it at the moment. It's estimated that there will be 3 million lung cancer deaths per year in China, just in China, in 2030. 3 million lung cancer deaths a year in China.
And is that from smoking and pollution?
It's largely smoking. Obviously, pollution is a significant issue in China, but overwhelmingly that number is due to smoking.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the programs American Cancer Society has in terms of alleviating this smoking problem.
Sure. The Cancer Society has done an enormous amount. The work in the Surgeon General's report was originally done, what is now referred to as CPS-1, or the Cancer Prevention Study 1. That was the original cancer prevention study that the American Cancer Society ran back in the early 60s. And they've done a number of studies, similar studies since then. And these studies over time have really provided a lot of the data that has told us what we know about smoking and cancer, and more recently what we know about diet and cancer. In addition, the American Cancer Society has focused very strongly on public awareness and public education efforts over the past 50 years, which have had a big impact. And more recently, and they've done lots of things about, for individual smokers, cancer quit lines, you know, providing materials and support for people who want to quit tobacco. And then recently they realized that, you know, a lot of tobacco work needs to be done on the state level in the legislatures and passing anti-smoking laws and tobacco regulations and increasing tobacco taxes, which have a dramatic impact on reducing smoking rates, especially in kids. When the cigarettes become too expensive to afford, the kids don't smoke or are less likely to smoke. So through what's called the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, they have worked heavily with legislatures around the country to provide appropriate support to tobacco legislation. So now many states in the country are, you know, have smoke-free laws in public places. Tobacco taxes have gone up, which have a dramatic impact on reducing tobacco rates. So these are, you know, just a series of examples of the way the ACS has been involved in trying to reduce tobacco smoking rates successfully over the last 50 years in the United States.
Do they have a global entity? Because it would seem to me that what they've done since this Surgeon General's report came out, that would be a template for a lot of countries, especially the ones that we were just talking about.
Yes and no. The American Cancer Society is the American Cancer Society, so it does not have an international presence, except that not an insignificant amount of ACS effort is spent on collaborating with similar organizations around the world, EORTC, other international organizations, the World Health Organization, that have cancer control efforts. The ACS cooperates with them all the time in trying to help develop best practices. We work closely with public health organizations and cancer control organizations in South America and Europe and in Asia to try and help develop things. There is also a international tobacco treaty, which the United States has not ratified to our shame, and the ACS has been very, very vocal about trying to get more countries to sign on to that, because it provides a framework for governments to take the kind of steps that have taken place in the United States to limit tobacco use, especially among youth. So while the ACS is an American organization and it's based here, it certainly works closely with sister organizations around the world to promote anti-cancer efforts really worldwide.
And you do that also in your cancer research in terms of networking with other cancer research agencies worldwide?
Yes, and cancer is a global health problem. So a lot of the work that the ACS funds has global reach, you know, just as the work that goes on at the Greenbaum Cancer Center has global reach. Angela Brody's drugs are in use all over the world. We have a very strong research collaboration with West Africa, a group in Nigeria called Institute of Human Virology Nigeria, and we're doing a lot of very interesting work with them about papillomavirus and cervical cancer and co-infection with HIV and how we can provide a global strategy based on research that's been done here and elsewhere to apply it to the specific needs of the Nigerian population.
Let's talk about what you see happening. I'm not going to hold you to it. Say 3 months, 6 months, a year, 5 years down the line. You said two steps ahead and one sideways, and will new strains come out, and will that be a hindrance?
Well, I think maybe to say what I said before in a different way. I think the first priority has to be to use the tools we have more effectively. Because if we just did that, we would have a dramatic impact around the world. If we just redoubled our efforts against tobacco, if we just worked harder to make people have a healthy diet and exercise appropriately, the health benefits of those two steps would be gigantic. If we applied vaccine strategies appropriately, vaccine and screening strategies appropriately, we would also have a tremendous impact. So just those three areas, tobacco, diet and exercise, cancer prevention, screening, and vaccines, we will wipe out, perhaps as much as 80% of the cancers that are out there today. The remaining 20% are going to be that's 2 months, 6 months, 3 months. We can do those things. Those are achievable in my lifetime. The remaining cancers are going to be harder, and they're going to require more research. But we have really lovely examples where when we can define the molecular and genetic abnormalities in a cancer really well, very frequently, not all the time, but very frequently, we can design a much more effective treatment for it. So some forms of leukemia that you used to require a bone marrow transplant and had a very hard time treating, a brilliant woman named Janet Rowley, who just died about 2 weeks ago, one of the real pioneers, she discovered a number of years ago that this form of leukemia called CML was due to a specific chromosome break and mutation. More research over the last few years led to the discovery that there was a specific gene that was involved in that. And then even more research showed, well, now we know that the abnormal protein that gene is making. And then a fellow named Brian Druker closed the loop and said, I designed a drug that will shut that off. And this discovery that Janet Rowley made a number of years ago, before she died, she saw somebody else come up with a medicine that cured that cancer with a pill. And so that's a great example of what we need to do for the remaining 20%. We can fix, probably 75-80% of the cancer problem that we have with what we know. The remaining 20% is going to require a lot more research and blood, sweat, and tears, but we have shining examples of when we've been able to really fix those problems. So I'm an optimist, and I'm very appreciative of the collective work that my colleagues and I have put in over the years, but I think we've seen great impact. The American Cancer Society, I think, has done a great job at focusing everyone's attention in appropriate ways to these areas. But I think if we use what we know and are intelligent about what we invest in future research effort, we can really, really come close to making cancer much, much less of a threat and much, much less of a public health issue than it is now.
Well, it's fascinating, and it's also exciting. The way you talk about Dr. Brody's work, and it's a great time, I think, for cancer research.
I absolutely agree. And the other thing that the American Cancer Society do and the Cancer Action Network is doing is trying to keep pressure on Congress not to cut cancer research funding. We've been in a difficult situation with the sequester where government is cutting significantly back on cancer research funding, and a lot of the really bright young scientists who will be around after I retire are leaving the field or not entering the field because the funding is so tight and it's so difficult to compete. And that's a real, real shame. If we're discouraging the next generation of researchers from coming into the field, I think we've done the country a great disservice.
Do you find that it's easier in Europe to get funding or to?
It's becoming easier in places where, that we're not strong research places. China is a great example. The Chinese government is investing a huge amount in biomedical research and cancer research specifically. And so a number of really strong investigators who came to the United States from China 20, 25 years ago are moving back. Which was something nobody ever envisioned. Normally, people, the best and the brightest, left China to come here to do research because they would have opportunities that weren't available then. Now they're finding that there may be better opportunities in China than there are here in the United States, and that's shocking to me. It's something I never dreamed would be the case, but it is.
I'd like to wrap it up now. What I hope is just an introductory interview, and I would like you to be an ongoing guest, and I would like the University of Maryland, Marlene and Stuart Greenebaum Cancer Center, to have shows throughout, because this is something that we need to continue. I think, and part of my remit in starting this station was that it would be opening Baltimore to the world. And right now I'm recording all programs, but I plan to go to live and record programs. And I want to network with like-minded individuals and professionals like yourself throughout the world. Is this something you might be interested in?
Sure, absolutely. I think, you know, I think, as you said, it's a very interesting and exciting story to tell. And I think I've talked about a few of the people at the Green Mountain Cancer Center, but there are many who are doing really fascinating, top-notch work that is really compelling. And it's important that the public understand what we're doing and be optimistic and enthusiastic about it, as we are. You know, we've received great support from the state of Maryland and through the Cigarette Restitution Fund. And I want people in the state and people in the legislature to know the great things that we're doing with that support. It's very important. So sure, we I think, you know, knowledge is power, and anything that we can do to get the word out is a good thing.
And I think it's important to network with other people like mine for the common purpose to exchange ideas and to see what other organizations are doing. I think it will enhance everybody, really.
I completely agree. So I applaud you for what you're doing, and happy to tell our story and help people who could benefit from the knowledge.
I've interviewed a few doctors and a few surgeons, and what's always come up too is what you said, and that is getting preventative medicine at the forefront, getting people out there to understand that their lifestyle needs to be improved. And I would like to do a few programs on that with doctors around the region and connect with other doctors too, because I think, like you said, you know, that eradicate a large amount of the upcoming cancers.
Sure, sure, absolutely.
Is there anything else you would like to add?
No, I enjoyed the conversation, and thanks for reaching out, and hopefully you'll be able to engage a good audience in this, and we're happy to tell our story in ways that would be useful to you.
So I want to thank you for being on Baltimore Internet Radio. I've been talking to Kevin J. Cullen, M.D., the director of the University of Maryland Marlene and Stuart Greenbaum Cancer Center. Thank you, Dr. Cullen.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
This is Dave Custy, and you've been listening to Baltimore Internet Radio.